I hope most of you will forgive the low level of some of this presentation, but I'm hoping maybe it won't be known to everyone. So basically the talk is going to be an n-dimensional Euclidean space. I'm going to assume that convex bodies always have the origin in their interiors. Actually, most of the talk, the pretty part, is if you assume that the bodies are symmetric about the origin, but I'm not going to make that assumption. So what do I need? I need the notion of the curvature function, which actually has come up in a number of talks already. So the curvature function is just 1 over the Gauss curvature, but it's parametrized in what's a strange way to many people. So the idea is, this is a function that if you feed it a unit vector u, what it'll do is it'll go off to the body, find the point on the boundary of the body that has outer normal u, and give you the value of 1 over the Gauss curvature at that point. And usually when I say curvature function, I'm going to be thinking curvature measures, and these are things that have come up in a number of talks already. And the curvature measure, just to remind you, is a Borel measure on the unit sphere. And if you give it a Borel set little omega, what it just does is it gives you the average of the curvature function on omega, one way of thinking of it. In case the body isn't smooth, what the curvature function does is, I'm going to put this slide back so I know I have 2 projectors. What the curvature function does is, if you give it, say, feed it a polytope, then the curvature function of the polytope is, the curvature measure of the polytope is just concentrated on a finite set of points, and it's the points on the sphere that correspond to the outer normals of the faces of the polytope. And at each one of these points, you have a weight, and the weight is just the n minus 1 dimensional volume, the area of the face corresponding to it. And actually, you know what? Let me use the other one, at least temporarily. If you have a convex body shaped like a cylinder over here, then this surface area measure, this curvature measure, is going to be a measure that's concentrated on the north pole and the south pole of the unit sphere, and it's going to also be concentrated on the great circle at the equator. So on the great circle of the equator, what are you going to have? You're going to have Lebesgue measure, and you're going to have Lebesgue measure times the area of the lateral part of the cylinder. Up on the north and the south pole, you're just going to get the areas of these pieces. That's what the weight is going to be on the top and bottom. So when I say curvature function, most of the time I'll be thinking curvature measure or surface area measure. And now I can get rid of this slide. The other thing I'm going to need is the notion of a support function, something that you've seen many times in other talks. I'm going to think of the support function as being defined on Rn take away the origin, because I'm going to need for the support function to be positive. And what do we know? We know that the support function is homogeneous of degree 1. And we know that it's sublinear. And frankly, that's all you need to know about it. So the support function will just give you the distance from the origin to the supporting hyperplane with outer normal u if you feed it a vector u. And last thing that I'm going to need in my setup is the notion of a polar body. So if we have a convex body Q, the polar body of Q is just the set of all X and Rn, so that X inner product Y is less than 1 for all Y in Q. So for example, if we have a cube, we have its polar body over here, we have a flat little cylinder over here, we have its polar body over here, and the polar body of the polar, just gives you back the original body. And of course, I can't resist whenever I define the polar body, mentioning the Bloch-Gesamtheorem inequality, which says that the product of the volume of a body and its polar is maximal only when the body is an ellipsoid. And I was very glad to wake up one day in August of 94 and open up the New York Times and find mention of the complementary Bloch-Gesamtheorem inequality, namely the Bergan-Milman inequality. And the Bergan-Milman inequality tells us asymptotically what the lower bound is over here. It's only known for zonoids, Reisner's inequality, what the actual sharp extremal bodies are for the complementary Bloch-Gesamtheorem inequality. And now what I'm going to do is move this over to here. And I'm just going to leave that. Okay. So central to convex geometry is the notion of Minkowski combinations of bodies, which we've seen many times during other talks. So the Minkowski combination of Q plus epsilon another body C is defined as, in terms of the support functions, you just take the linear combination of the support function. And here's a little picture of a Minkowski combination of a cube and a ball that I believe I stole right out of Richard's book. It is out of your book, right?
Yes.
So, here's basically the heart of the talk I'm going to try to give, which is to try to convince you that you could do curvature without geometry. So even if you hadn't taken a course in differential geometry and learned what Gauss curvature was, I maintain you could stumble across it anyway. So if you take two bodies, Q and C, and you take the first variation of volume of Q in the direction of C, what you get is you get a functional that's going to depend on C and Q. And actually, a not too difficult application of the Riesz representation theorem will get you to the point where you can see that what you wind up with is an integral of the support function of C integrated against some other function. The other function happens to be the curvature function, and I maintain that you could have discovered the curvature function even if you didn't know anything about curvature. And I'm going to try to present some evidence to support that. To do that, I need to make a tiny, tiny little detour. And the detour is to look at Minkowski-Fiery LP combinations of bodies. So in the early 60s, Bill Fiery had this wonderful idea. He said, well, suppose we look at a real P bigger than 1. So let's assume that P is fixed, bigger than 1. Bill Fiery said, suppose we look at the LP combination of these support functions what would we get? And it turns out that the new function that you get satisfies the conditions necessary to be a support function. And the new animal that you're going to get is a new body that I'm just denoting with a little p under the plus sign. And a little picture might help you visualize what's going on. So what you see over here is a fiery LP combination of a square and a circle. And this is the familiar case, p equals 1. Here's p equals 2. Here's p equals 10. And here's p equals 100. Now, you notice it says on top here that p is fixed. And that's the way we're going to think of it, except in this little picture. Let me put the other slide back, defining the fiery Minkowski LP combination. So, basically the way the game is played is you look for the number 1, you replace it by a P. So you look at the classical Brun-Minkowski theory, and wherever you see a 1, you try to put in a P. So, suppose you had no idea of what LP curvature is, and I don't know why you should have any idea of what it is. So what you do is you do the same thing that was done originally with defining ordinary curvature functions. Now, what could have been done? You take the first variation, but with respect to this fiery LP combination, you change the 1 over here to a P. There's a little 1 up here that gets changed to a P. And the animal that's on the right-hand side, you call that LP curvature. Well, okay, what can you do with it? So let's start with ellipsoids associated with convex bodies. So what is an ellipsoid associated with a convex body? Well, an ellipsoid associated with a convex body is a function. It's a function defined on convex bodies, taking values in the set of ellipsoids centered at the origin. Now, we'll say that an ellipsoid is linearly associated or affinely associated with the convex body, provided that a GLN transformation of the body is going to transform the ellipsoid associated with it in exactly the same way. So, let me do a drop of backtracking. Associated with each ellipsoid is its moment matrix, and this is a one-to-one correspondence between the real positive definite symmetric matrices M and the ellipsoids, using this definition that the ellipsoid is generated by all X in Rn such that X inner product Mx is less than or equal to 1. Now, probably the most famous, I believe the oldest ellipsoid associated with a convex body is the Legendre ellipsoid, which I'm denoting by E2 over here. And it's generated by the matrix M2, where the inverse of M2 has an ijth element that's the integral over the interior of K of the ith component of X, jth component of X, dx. Now, if you take any GLN transformation and transform the body K with that transformation and ask the question, what happens to M2? Well, what happens to the M2 of the Legendre ellipsoid is this. This thing over here is a little penalty I'm paying for lying about the fact that I've left out a constant in front of this involving the volume. Now, a couple of years ago, Dean Yang, Gaoyang Zhang, and I introduced a new ellipsoid whose matrix is given by, well, what you do is you integrate this time not over Rn, you integrate over the unit sphere, and you integrate U sub I, U sub j, the ith and jth component, multiplied together, against the L2 curvature function of the body. Now, whenever I give this definition, I'm always asked, well, can't you give us a more concrete explanation of what it is? So, in case P is a polytope, what you're going to do is you're going to take the sum over all outer normals U of the area of the face with outer normal U divided by the support function of the body in that direction. And you're going to sum UI, UJ weighted by this over all outer unit normals. Now, that doesn't look like it's linearly associated. And actually, because there's a volume term left out, it's just an SLN associated. But in fact, you can prove that this is an SLN invariant concept. And if you ask, how does the matrix generating the ellipse interact with an GLN transformation of the body, this is the answer. Okay, big deal. A new ellipsoid. There are so many of them. What's the big deal about a new ellipsoid? Well, for this ellipsoid, there are volume bounds. So for this new ellipsoid, you can actually say the volume of this new ellipsoid is bounded by some constant times the volume of the body with equality if and only if the body is a simplex. And the volume of the ellipsoid is less than or equal to the volume of the body times some other constant with equality if and only if the body is an ellipsoid. So you might say, okay, you've got volume bounds for this, but thanks to Keith Ball, don't we have volume bounds on the John ellipsoid? Well, yeah, you've got bounds on the John ellipsoid, but you have no formula for the John ellipsoid. All you know about the John ellipsoid is it exists. For this one, you not only have volume bounds, but you also have a formula for it. For the Legendre ellipsoid, you have a formula, you have no volume bounds. Okay? Not convinced. So, this is a teaser for Monica Ludwig's talk, which she's going to give tomorrow.
Can you say a question in the meantime?
Please.
This is computable ellipsoid?
Computable. You can write down, you can...
This ellipsoid is computable, which means that you may find after some very few words, say, polynomial, but even L log N random point, you see the side of this, and you organize some formula, and you get a very good approximation of the genre. It's some kind of important question. If... from point of view of whatever called
right.
computer science, if some ellipsoid is computable.
Are there and other examples besides the Legendre?
No, no one. And by ideology, which I gave one time present here, every other should almost coincide. Otherwise, you would distinguish two spaces, which I don't believe possible.
So you believe the Legendre is the only one?
Every other would be almost Legendre. which may be computable, in fact, very close, logarithmically close to this, more or less. So it is my question, because you said formula, but it will also be computable. You know, not any formula computable.
So I don't know. I don't know.
Because it's currently
all right, so this is just a teaser for Monica Ludwig's talk. So essentially what Monica Ludwig has shown is that if you ask the question, suppose you want to associate with each polytope an n by n matrix, and you want this association to be a valuation, and I will just remind you that a valuation is just a function that satisfies the inclusion-exclusion principle. Suppose you want this function to be a valuation that transforms affinely, or should I say linearly, and what that just means is that for some q, you pick the q, it doesn't matter what q is, you're going to get this sort of a transformation. So what Monica Ludwig's theorem says is that essentially, I don't want to let you read it carefully. You have to go to her talk. That's the whole point, Vitaly. I mean, if I let you read it carefully, come on. So essentially what it says is that all you have is M2, M-2, or if you take M2 or M-2 of the polars of the bodies. Now, Dean Yang and Gao-Yang Chang and I have been looking at sort of these things that we call LP-John ellipsoids. And what the LP-John ellipsoids do is they sort of connect this new dual of the Legendre ellipsoid with the Petty ellipsoid and the classical John ellipsoid. So if you recall, the Petty ellipsoid is an ellipsoid defined by maximizing the volume of the ellipsoid subject to certain constraints. Well, if you do the same thing, if you play the same game, but you play it with LP curvature, then you get these ellipsoids, E sub P for each P, and you get a family of ellipsoids that connects the John ellipsoid, the Petty ellipsoid, and this new ellipsoid. And from reading the program for next week, I understand that what will be presented is the dual analog of this setup over here. So we move on to another topic for LP curvature. So I just want to remind you of what the definition is of classical affine surface area. So this has come up again in a number of talks. So classical affine surface area of a convex body Q is really just the integral of the curvature function raised to the n over n plus 1 power. What do we know? We know that this functional is translation invariant. We know that if we hit the body Q with an SLN transformation, that nothing's going to change. We know that this function is a valuation. It's upper semi-continuous. And then we have the very important affine isoperimetric inequality, which says that the affine surface area raised to the right power is less than or equal to a constant times the volume raised to the right power, with equality if and only if Q is an ellipsoid. I should just briefly mention that that notion of classical affine surface area was extended in the early 90s, and theorem, which I really consider amazing, the Ludwig-Reitzner characterization theorem, which says that if you have a functional that satisfies properties 1, 2, and 3, then that functional must be a linear combination of affine surface area, volume, plus a constant. So we move on to LP affine surface area. So remember, what are we doing? What we're doing is the name of the game is we're finding the number 1 and we're replacing it with P. So you look at the definition of affine surface area, you're going to take the ordinary curvature function, you're going to replace it with the LP curvature function, and you're going to take this number 1 over here and you're going to replace it with a P. And it turns out that this new functional that you get is also going to be an SLN invariant functional. Daniel Hoog showed that this functional is going to be evaluation. It's upper semi-continuous. And if the body is properly positioned, it satisfies the affine isoparametric inequality. But what you need to do is go over to the affine isoparametric inequality and change all of the 1s to P's. And amazingly enough to me, Daniel Hoog showed that if you look at the case P is equal to the dimension, then the LP affine surface area is just centro, classical centro affine surface area. Now, originally, LP affine surface area was only defined for P bigger than 1, but Daniel Hoog showed that it could be extended to all P bigger than 0. And what I'm particularly amazed about is that lately, Elizabeth Werner and with Matthew Mayer, with Carsten Schutt, in a number of places, has been able to show that it's actually a concept that can be extended for all P, even plus and minus infinity, except P is equal to minus the dimension. And there have been new approaches to LP affine surface area. So in Daniel Hook's thesis, he already introduced new definitions and showed how they could be used to derive things like the valuation property. Matthew Mayer and Elizabeth Werner showed that there's actually a geometric definition possible of LP affine surface area, and they did that in terms of generalized Santolo bodies. And Schutt and Werner gave a geometric description, a characterization of LP affine surface area in terms of random polytopes. Elizabeth Werner then did it in terms of weighted floating bodies. There's the Schutt-Werner one in terms of surface bodies. I get the feeling that your talk should have gone after this one. No. And Monica Ludwig has, and Elizabeth Werner even have an approach, the WIP, that's work in progress, have an approach where they believe that there's a kind of axiomatic characterization of the different constructions of LP affine surface area. And last over here is this, again, amazing result that Monica Ludwig has that says that if you have a functional and its evaluation, upper semi-continuous and homogeneous of degree Q, where Q is between minus N and plus N, but not 0, and then there's one other condition necessary, that if you dilate with respect to the ball, then you should have continuity, not just upper semi-continuity. But what Monica Ludwig has shown, that a functional that satisfies these four conditions, if the degree of homogeneity is n, then that functional has to be volume. If the degree of homogeneity is minus n, then that functional has to be volume of the polar body. And if the degree of homogeneity is something between minus n and plus n, then it's one of the LP affine surface areas where P is chosen so that you have this homogeneity of degree Q. Well, here's another place where LP curvature enters. Let me remind you of the definition of projection bodies, which has come up a number of times during the talks in the last 2.5 days. So the projection operator is an operator that takes convex bodies into zonoids. And the support function of the projection body of a convex body Q is nothing more than the cosine transform of the curvature function, where the cosine transform is defined by this integral over here. So a nice way to think of the cosine transform is to think of it as peeling an orange. So you're integrating along these circles, and all that happens is that the weight changes as you move down from a weight of 1 down to a weight of 0. So you feed the curvature function into the cosine transform, and what you get is the projection body of the convex body. And the two big inequalities that are connected with projection bodies is first the Petty projection inequality, which says that the maximum of the polar of the projection body, pi star q is just pi of q star, the maximum of the volume of the polar of the projection body times the volume of the body taken to the only power that you can, that this maximum occurs only when the body is an ellipsoid. And the Chang projection inequality, of which you saw a stability version presented at this meeting already, says that the minimum of this thing occurs only when the body Q is a simplex. Now, I really don't have enough time to talk about why these inequalities are so important in their applications to, say, geometric tomography, but I would like to mention that the Petty projection inequality is a much stronger inequality than the classical isoperimetric inequality. So, LP curvature, what do? Well, you know the game already. We change all the ones to P's. So, there is an LP cosine transform. It's been around for a long time. It's just like the ordinary cosine transform, except you take the inner product and you raise it to the pth power. So you define the LP projection body of Q to be the body whose support function raised to the pth power is equal to the LP cosine transform of the LP curvature function. Now, you could try to feed something else into there. For example, you could try to feed the LP cosine transform the ordinary curvature function, but you wouldn't get a body that's affinely associated to the original body. So what do we need? Well, we need an LP analog of the Petty projection inequality. What is the LP Petty projection inequality? It's just the polar of the LP projection body raised to the pth power. You take the 1, you change it to a p, And Dean Yang, Gao Yang Zhang, and I were able to prove that, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. But we were not able to, and I think this is an important conjecture, to be able to show that this product is minimized when Q is a simplex. I should just mention that this inequality over here, the LP Petty projection inequality, Campi and Grunschi found a brand new approach, totally different from the one that we used, and that appeared, I believe, in last month's issue of the Advances in Math. Centroid bodies. Well, the centroid body of a convex body, which I'm denoting by gamma Q, the centroid body, is defined as the body whose support function at x is equal to 1 over the volume of the body integral all y in the body Q of x inner product y. And a nice geometric description, if you think of Q as being the convex body and it's symmetric about the origin, then what you would do is you take any direction that you want, say this one, and you look at the upper half of the body, you find the centroid of this upper half, and you put a little dot over there, and you do the same thing on the other one. And if you look at the locus of all such points, that's actually up to a constant, the centroid body. Now, Blaschke conjectured and Petty proved what's become known as the Busemann-Petty centroid inequality, which says that the volume of the centroid body is bigger than the volume of the body times some constant with equality if and only if the body is an ellipsoid. So, LP centroid bodies. Well, LP centroid bodies, I maintain, have actually been around for a while. I saw them in a talk this morning. Shlomo Reisner's talk, the question came up of what is the diameter, I believe, of the LP centroid body of the LP ball. Now, Gao Yang Zhang and I, before we started working with Dean, conjectured that the volume of the LP centroid body should be minimized given a body of fixed volume only if you're dealing with an ellipsoid. And again, Dean Yang, Gao Yang, Zhang, and I were able to prove that indeed the LP Petty projection inequality implies the conjectured LP centroid body inequality. And again, a different approach to this thing was just presented by Campi and Grunschi. The Minkowski problem, something that came up this morning. So let me remind you that the classical Minkowski problem concerns the existence, uniqueness, regularity, and stability of the following question. Suppose you're given a positive function, notice positive function. The question is, does there exist a convex hypersurface Q whose curvature function is equal to that given function? So, what is the LP Minkowski problem ask? Well, it asks exactly the same question. You're given a positive function G, and the question is there an LP curvature function that's equal to the given function G? And here is the first time I'm telling you what LP curvature is. Now, at this point, if I were in the audience and I hadn't heard this before, I would feel cheated. I'd say, wait a minute, this is what LP curvature is? It's just the support function raised to the 1 minus p power times ordinary curvature function? What's the big deal? Well, see, I actually believe that that first variation of volume with respect to a fiery LP combination has been computed many times. I actually believe a lot of people did that. They did it. They got this as an answer in the integral. And they said, okay, we know all of this. What's the big deal? And they walked away from it. I maintain that in this case, ignorance is really the right approach. Knowing what LP curvature is not in your best interest. Calling it something and trying to work with it is. So that's the LP Minkowski problem, and you can see from that problem up there that this thing is a problem that's of interest for all real P. P no longer has to be positive. In fact, if you think about it as a problem for all real P, it begins to connect a number of questions. So, for example, for P equals zero, this problem was posed by Bill Fiery, and just recently, I think 2 years ago or 3 years ago, solved completely by Ben Andrews. For P equals minus N, it's an old question in affine differential geometry. I maintain that this thing is an interesting question for all real P, and it's interesting whether the driving function G is continuous, smooth, discrete, whatever. In fact, I maintain it's even an interesting question for the one-dimensional version of the problem. And in the one-dimensional version of the problem, it's no longer a partial differential equation, but it's an ordinary differential equation. And that's the equation up there. So you're given a 2-pi periodic continuous function G, and the question is there a 2-pi periodic function Y satisfying this simple-looking differential equation? Now, it turns out that Gage and Lee had solved this thing back in 95 for the case P is equal to zero for completely different reasons. Yamansky recently did the work for P is equal to 2. And the next part of the slide is a trailer for Alina Stanku's talk, so I won't say too much about this, but Alina has handled the case of P is equal to zero, and G is a discrete measure. And her talk will be right after this one. And here's what, in fact, I'm most happy with. So, and the reason I'm most happy with this is because it's a result that uses things from LP curvature but has absolutely nothing to do with LP curvature. So what I did up on top is I put up the classical LP sub 11 equality. Now, a couple of years ago, Gaoyang Chang was able to obtain what I really consider an amazing affine strengthening of the classical sub 11 equality. What he was able to show is that between the two things that are considered the classical sub 11 equality, you could put in this quantity over here. And this is, in fact, an important item. Let me just explain what it is. So, let me move this up a little bit. So, you've got a function f, d sub v of f is the directional derivative of f in the direction of v. So that's what you're looking at. And what you do is you take the LP norm of this function. So you do d directional derivative of f in the direction v, evaluate it at x, raise to the pth power, average, take the pth root. And what he was able to show is that, in fact, you have a much stronger inequality than the classical sub-11 inequality. what you have is that this quantity over here is greater than this, and this actually gives you an affine inequality. And the ingredients of Chang's proof were a very important extension that Chang obtained of the Petty projection inequality and the solution of the Minkowski problem. And very recently, Dean Yang, Jiayong Chang, and I were able to get the LP version of that inequality, which we had actually worked very, very hard to get. And what are the ingredients in the proof of that one? Well, it's the new LP Petty projection inequality along with the solution of the even LP Minkowski problem. And tomorrow you will hear a detailed talk on that. This, again, is the trailer. Thank you very much.
Which you care so much, which is very important for you, I guess.
Yes?
Every measure of ellipsoid just some kind of isotropic type description. There is this measure to which it is the thought, and this measure connected and also helped to establish inequalities. Say, we know more inequalities than you mentioned, which was bound unknown, whether or not real and so on. So, what is isotropic description? What measure associated with? You understand that isotropicity is a deep description. Anyway,
don't know.
This would say something. Right? If it is natural, so it should be very important.
Don't know. Yet.
Okay. And if I have another question, but it's absolutely historical, not connected much with your talk, but only with your remark that you define polar body. And here so much expert, I always want to ask, what is the source of polarity? This is an incredible, not trivial notion. And I ask this because I have almost feeling that perhaps Legendre ellipsoid, when it was introduced, it was polarity with Binet ellipsoid. It started just notion of polarity, but I believe here there are people who know.
Oh, maybe Rolf?
It is Mikhail, 19th century, but from what polarity came? What? Polar body. How? Why suddenly for convex body you decide that there exists another body called polar, which is connected, important, you know, functional analysis started later. Later started, it's used this one. So from what source it came?
How it should be much earlier.
What?
I think at least at the beginning of projective geometry, this notion was introduced in one way or another. So
when you went for platonic solids, they knew about duality between different platonic solids. So for example, as well as that itself.
And so how it was finally come to formulation? What was the you know this new conjecture?
I have to try to show some developments in